Maybe your government isn't always out for you. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's Jack Kennedy who's the one who's out for you. And they get to him first. So that means people should know more about the country they live in and the meaning of public relations and foreign policy, because they are involved and they can't keep it away by pushing it away. The same thing's true about the continued concealment of the murder of John Kennedy. They can't put it away. They have to confront it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Ted Midward. Thanks for tuning in again. I think we have something interesting today that we'll be going over, something that if you have not heard it before, it's going to be extremely interesting. I know I certainly found it that way myself. Let me start off, before we jump right into it, let me give a little background. It is the month of November. Veterans Day has come and gone, and there was a big event in American history that happened in the month of November. Of course, I'm referring to the assassination of our 35th president, John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Now, before listeners get all riled up and go too far overboard and jump to conclusions here, I am not saying that this man was particularly the best man, nor the best president. I'm fully aware of their liberal tendencies and their feelings of wanting to extend civil rights to blacks, which I think has been a total disaster in America. That being said, I think most listeners would agree that the man was murdered, there was a conspiracy to do it, and that the cover story about Lee Harvey Oswald being the lone nut assassin is pretty much garbage, and I don't think very many of you out there would disagree with that. In fact, I'm quite sure that most of the listeners out there would most certainly side with us when we say that there was a political conspiracy to assassinate John Fitzgerald Kennedy while he was president because of the many enemies that he made and because of his political stance and what his agenda was while he was in office. A lot of people don't like the Kennedys. They see them as liberal elitists, and there's certainly no doubt that they had questionable character traits and engaged in some very sinful extramarital activities. And I'm not defending any of that. That stuff's kind of window dressing to the main issue that I want to talk about. Joe Kennedy, in particular, I think, based on what I've read about him and what others have written, and some pretty notable authors, Ronald Kessler is a big American author who's written many political books and has a pretty serious level of clout when it comes to these things. Seymour Hersh, who wrote The Dark Side of Camelot, just to name a few. There's many others, but Joseph Kennedy made his money bootlegging and in mob-connected activities, shall we say, and made a fortune after the Great Depression, getting out of the stock market at the top and selling short, and then also with his bootlegging activities, with his Irish connections. And in the city of Boston, in particular, where the Irish more or less had a grip on activities, happenings in the entire city, and they were able to bootleg in alcohol, and of course, Joe Kennedy coming up in this world, being a big player in the bootlegging scene and the organized crime scene, he ran into quite a few people. The Gambino family of New York, the Giancanas of Chicago, Sam Giancana in particular, and Joe's kids, particularly Bobby Kennedy, boy, they would have their run-ins with Sam Giancana later on down the road. But Joseph Kennedy ran with this crowd. He knew this crowd. He knew how to work this crowd. He knew how to use these people as political resources. And that is what they did. That's what he did to get his son John in the presidency. So he knows all these people in the underworld. Carlos Marcello, Santos Traficante out of Florida, Giancanas and Gambinos, like I've already mentioned. And I'm sure if you've you've all heard this story before, the JFK assassination's been around for 50-plus years now. It's a very interesting subject, and it's one of the first subjects that I really bit my teeth on as a teenager and got a little bit of an education and saw a scam and a cover-up story for what it was. In the JFK assassination, to me personally, it does hold a special place because it was the first, one of the first quote-unquote conspiracy topics that I ever really looked into and that I found absolutely extraordinary when I found out more details about what really happened and how the Warren Commission official story is an illusion, a pack of lies. So y'all know the story about Joseph Kennedy, the bootlegging, the money-making. He was more or less an American tycoon by the time he died in 1961 with his boys coming up the ranks of American politics. The Kennedys, make no mistake about it, while not Jewish, while staunch Roman Catholics and Irish Celtic background, they moved in circles with the powerful mob families, powerful Jewish families, and many people have written about Joseph Kennedy and his lack of love and his sense of competition with this particular crowd. There's a lot of information out there about this, and there are some pretty big authors, some pretty notable authors who have documented it in their books. I mentioned Cy Hirsch. I mentioned Ronald Kessler. Those are two notable ones, but many people know the story, know the background story of Joseph Kennedy and his ambassadorship during FDR's watch to Great Britain or to the United Kingdom, and how he had to resign that because he was pro-German, he was pro-Hitler, and he tried to stop America getting involved in World War II. Now, many people who haven't looked into it, they don't really know that. Now, I think that's quite astonishing. And I think that the Kennedys ought to be recognized or given due credit because they had all this money, they had all this prestige. They could have just as easily gone along with the establishment and screwed everyone over and become more powerful, more wealthy, and become god kings of American politics, but that's not what they did. That is not what they did. As I said, Joseph Kennedy was a committed Catholic, and it is said that he spent his life battling Jews that he saw as competitors because of their immense level of success, not only in the American business world, but also in the underworld, too. In his 1996 book, Sins of the Father, Joe Kennedy and the Dynasty He Founded, award-winning journalist Ronald Kessler, that's Kessler with two S's, wrote about how Joe Kennedy went out to Hollywood and how he told his friends that he expected to wipe out the Jewish pant pressers who ruled Hollywood. In that same book, Kessler would go on to say, Joe Kennedy's feelings towards Jews was the only way he could be a success, was that every day when he got up, he would focus on one deal involving one Jew, and he would win that deal. That was his whole driving spirit. Let me read that again. Joe Kennedy's feeling towards Jews was that the only way he could be a success was that every day when he got up, he would focus on one deal involving one Jewish person, and he would set out to win that deal. That was his whole driving spirit. Speaking of his stay in Hollywood, Joe Kennedy allegedly said, "I couldn't leave. If I left for 2 days, the Jews would rob me blind." Now, the background of this is that Joe was involved. I think he purchased a movie production company, a real small one, and kind of turned it around and made it more successful, or continued its success. That's what that's referring to. Now, Seymour Hersh, in his book, The Dark Side of Camelot, he has it included in his book that a claim that Joe had told friends, Joe Kennedy told his friends, individual Jews are all right, but as a race, they stink. They spoil everything they touch. Look what they did to the movies. He also added that Kennedy and his entourage generally referred to Jews as kikes or sheenies. Hersh also claimed that in a meeting with a German ambassador, Kennedy mentioned that very strong anti-Semitic feelings existed in the United States, and that a large portion of the population had an understanding of the German attitude towards the Jews. In 1938, Joe Kennedy became U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom in London. During World War II, Joe clashed with Winston Churchill and supported Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasement toward Hitler's Germany. Joe also argued strongly against the United States giving military and economic aid to Britain. In fact, Joe attempted to arrange a meeting with Adolf Hitler without the approval of the State Department. He claimed his goal was to bring about a better understanding between the United States and Germany. When the Roosevelt administration read Joe's quotes on democracy being, quote, finished, in his belief that the Battle of Britain was not about fighting for democracy, FDR pressured Joe to resign. Joe Kennedy would end up submitting his resignation in November of 1940. And of course, this is one of his few failed attempts at a political pursuit or a business pursuit in his life, the failure to keep the United States out of World War II. He was up against forces in the FDR administration that he didn't quite understand, or that he may have underestimated. I'm going to go on to an excerpt that I found in Michael Collins Piper's book, Final Judgment, which probably has the most unique thesis about the JFK assassination, in the fact that JFK, in his bitter dealings with the Israelis, particularly either Menachem Begin or David Ben-Gurion, I can't remember which, but he more or less told the Israelis, you're not getting a nuclear program, and that you will face international inspections of your nuclear program should you pursue one. And they're out there, people know about the absolutely maniacal love relationship that Israel has with its nuclear program. Israel sees nuclear weapons as the ultimate. If they don't have nuclear weapons, they feel that their right to exist has been challenged on this planet. They are absolutely in love with nuclear weapons, and I think it was Cy Hirsch that wrote the book, The Samson Option, about how Israel has basically all of Europe under nuclear blackmail if they don't get their way. Anyways, I found a story in Final Judgment that Mike Piper told after he had an interview with DeWest Hooker. DeWest Hooker is one of those little-known, kind of obscure names in white nationalist history, and he had dealings, or I believe he was a mentor to George Lincoln Rockwell at one point in his life. Now, George Lincoln Rockwell, his father had many connections to Hollywood, too, that most people never bring up. But here's the story from Final Judgment. In 1956, Joe Kennedy met with DeWest Hooker in Palm Beach, Florida, for a game of golf. According to DeWest Hooker, Joe admitted that when he was ambassador to England, he had been pro-Hitler. However, in Kennedy's words, "We lost the war." By "we," he didn't mean the United States. When Kennedy said "we," he meant the non-Jews. Joe Kennedy believed that it was the Jews who had won World War II. Hooker claimed that Kennedy added, "I've done everything I can to fight the Jewish power in this country. I tried to stop World War II, but I failed. I've made all the money I need, and now I'm passing on everything I've learned to my sons." Kennedy explained that, "I don't go with the loser. I've joined the winners. I'm going to work with the Jews. I'm teaching my boys the whole score, and they're going to work with the Jews." Kennedy concluded, "I'm going to make Jack the first Irish Catholic president of the United States, and if it means working with the Jews, so be it." Later in this meeting, Joe Kennedy assured DeWest Hooker that a long-term aim of the Kennedy dynasty would be the destruction of what Joe referred to as the Rothschild-dominated Federal Reserve. Quite interesting, don't you think, folks? Are you folks awake out there, or are you sleeping? I hope I've gotten your interest if you don't know this story yet. Now, of course, we all know the official story of what happened with the run-up to the election of 1960 between Kennedy and Nixon, which I guess Nixon was the standing vice president under Eisenhower, and there's many interesting things about Nixon that I'll hopefully in this segment get into later in this program before it's over. Let's go back to the official story of the 1960 election. JFK barely defeated Nixon in 1960. And according to the popular vote, I want to say Nixon lost to JFK by about two-tenths of 1%, one percentage point, if I'm remembering this correctly. Many believe that Joseph Kennedy, the father of John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy and Ted, arranged a deal with the mob, that would be Sam Giancana, to send Chicago's electoral votes to his son in order to win the White House. And we know the rest of the story about Oswald allegedly killing Kennedy and then Jack Rubenstein killing Oswald 2 days later. But here's something that many people don't know. William Kunstler, Howard Kunstler, I can't remember what his, I think it's William. He was a Jewish attorney, and he was a radical attorney at that. He wrote in his 1994 autobiography, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, about a conversation he had with Rubenstein after the shooting. Here's the excerpt. "When Jack Rubenstein told me he had killed Oswald for the Jews, quote-unquote, I believed him. On each of three occasions we talked, he said, 'Bill, I did this so they wouldn't implicate the Jews.'" Kunstler added that, "During our last visit, he handed me a note in which he reiterated his desire to protect American Jews from a pogrom that could occur because of anger over the assassination." Interesting, don't you think? Now, Jack Ruby, his real name being Jacob Rubenstein, was, of course, a big figure of the Dallas underworld. And Jack Ruby goes all the way back to Chicago. And my thinking is that he wasn't necessarily kicked out of Chicago for stepping on toes there, trying to be the number one big shot. I think more or less he was a liaison, and they sent him down to Texas to expand the network. That may prove to be incorrect, but that's just my thinking at the moment. But Jacob Rubenstein, Jack Ruby, he was a runner for Al Capone in the 20s in the Chicagoland area. So this guy is no Johnny come lately. He knows mob dealings. He knows the underworld. He knows how to get things done. And he certainly has that reputation in Dallas. And he is at least the front guy, if not the owner, of the Carousel Club in Dallas, which many people will later testify. Many witnesses, many eyewitnesses in Dealey Plaza will testify later on. Of course, they'll be ignored by the Warren Commission, but they will testify that they had seen Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald together at the Carousel Club, that they were friends, acquaintances, they knew each other, and a few people would even go on to say that they saw Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Officer J.D. Tippit, who was murdered the very day that JFK is murdered in Dallas. J.D. Tippit is murdered within a half hour afterward. And, of course, Lee Harvey Oswald will be blamed for that murder as well. Let's go back to the story of 1960 and the election. The story goes that Joe Kennedy does not have a direct link to Sam Giancana, so that he can't necessarily arrange a connection, but he does have a connection to Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra, who I never knew this, I had a grandfather who loved Frank Sinatra. Anything that wasn't Frank Sinatra music-wise was noise and garbage, in his opinion, right? He was born in the 20s, and Frank Sinatra was the guy for my grandfather's generation. But Frank Sinatra went to the Giancanas. Frank Sinatra grew up with the mob boys, ran with the street gangs in his coming up, and he was a friend to the mobsters in the 60s in those days. And Joe Kennedy solicits Frank Sinatra to put in a good word to the Giancanas out of Chicago. Sam and I think Chuck is his brother. To put in a good word and to throw money behind Kennedy's run for the presidency, and that they'll work with them. They will be protected in of sorts. Sam Giancana would later go on to say, and I believe this is in wiretap tapes too, that the mob out of Chicago was very close to pulling the trigger, pun intended, on Frank Sinatra after the Kennedy boys had backstabbed the mob with Bobby Kennedy's Department of Justice undertakings to destroy the mob via legal means, cracking down on them. In the Eisenhower days, there were about 19 open investigations on organized crime under the Department of Justice. Under the Kennedy administration, in a matter of just 3 years, they would have over 600 pending cases. So you can see the staggering amount and how Bobby Kennedy in particular went after organized crime. So the mob decides eventually they very, very well may kill Frank Sinatra for vouching for Joseph Kennedy and his boys. But as the story goes, they do deliver Chicago and West Virginia, and I think votes in Texas too, to the Kennedys. There is some dispute whether or not Kennedy would have won without the mob's help. That very well could have been the case. But the popular vote was very close. He did win the electoral vote, the electoral college votes, which is what matters in a presidential election. But the popular vote across the country was very close. It was neck and neck. So whether Kennedy could have stood on his own without the mob, I don't know. The mob certainly did help. I think there's no mistake about that. Now, as the story goes, the mob would give, I want to say, about $500,000 to Richard Nixon, too. They kind of hedged their bets, and everyone was hopping on the Kennedy train, and Frank Sinatra, I think, recorded a song about, glorifying John Kennedy. And I'm pretty sure the story goes that Giancana and maybe some others like Santos Traficante out of Florida and maybe Carlos Marcello out of Texas and Louisiana might have done the same thing. They hedged their bets, and they gave to Nixon as well. So the Kennedy boys get in there. And, well, I'm not going to go any further. This is just the background that I was painting before I get into the meat and potatoes. And what I wanted to do for the meat and potatoes of the program is I wanted to discuss, make a case. The case against Lyndon Baines Johnson. And I know what people are thinking. They're thinking, oh my God, Ted, what are you, trying to blame Lyndon Baines Johnson for the assassination of John Kennedy? Don't you know it was the Jews? Don't you know the Jews hold all the power? Don't you know this and that? I hear you. Before I had looked at all the evidence pointing towards Lyndon Baines Johnson and, of course, his backers, his donors, his handlers, his connections, which are, I tell you, they're as deep as anything. Lyndon Johnson was a connected man. Lyndon Johnson served his people behind the scenes very well, and he was rewarded handsomely for it. But I want to talk about today the case against Lyndon Baines Johnson that a few people have written about. And back in my teenage years, looking into this, I didn't have the slightest clue of who could have done this. I thought it was some kind of a Illuminati bankster conspiracy, and that we'll never really know who done it. All we can do is tear apart the official story. Well, today I've seen more information, and I've spent a lot of time on this. I just read a couple books, over 400 pages, about this particular subject, and I'm going to try to bring the information to you as concisely as possible, try to make it an entertaining story for you, and try to document as much as possible this story. But at first, when I had heard this, I thought, no, I think Mike Piper was right that the Israelis or Zionist Jews were behind this to get Kennedy out of the way because of his stance against escalating the war in Vietnam, his stance on issuing debt-free money, about $4 million worth of silver-backed money, treasury notes, and that the Kennedys were going to stop the Jews, this and that. But look, there is a considerable case to be made about LBJ being the point man for the entire conspiracy to kill John F. Kennedy. And I'm going to hopefully successfully lay that out to you and give you something to think about. I'm not saying this is 100% bulletproof. I'm not saying this is 100% what happened. What I am saying is that there is a considerable, almost an overwhelming amount of evidence to suggest that Lyndon Johnson was not only the man who benefited the most, but had the most to gain, not only out of a power grab, but out of survival. You can say that there's a strong motive to kill someone to gain something, but there's an even stronger motive, I would argue, to kill someone or commit a crime to protect your own hide. And I think that's exactly what Lyndon Johnson was up against. He knew he was in serious trouble, serious legal trouble, because of his past graft and corruption and money laundering and bribes and pay-to-play financial schemes that everyone talks about the Bushes and Clintons today. But really, it was LBJ, in my opinion, who wrote the book and was the original American politician, American president, American senator, gangster. That was Lyndon Johnson. I am very well convinced of it now. This man, I cannot say enough bad things about this man. And look, I know people want to jump on the Jews, and rightly so in many cases, and point to them as being the root of all the evil. And certainly that is the case in many instances, particularly in 9/11, in my opinion. But we have to come to grips with people that And I don't, people bring up this argument that Lyndon Baines Johnson was Jewish, that his mother was Jewish, this or that. Maybe he was, maybe he wasn't. I'm going to go with the thought line that he wasn't. Whether he was or wasn't is really immaterial at the end of the day. And people throw these accusations out there about Adolf Hitler, him being a British agent, being a Jew, being a Rothschild. Say the same thing about Abraham Lincoln. Try to paint him as a Jew or as some kind of Canaanite or this or that. Does it really matter if he was or not? Isn't it more important what he really did? We have this idea that if there's any evil, that no Gentiles or Goyim are involved in it, and that it's strictly the Jews and the Jews are to blame. And I think that's pretty lame. We need to come to grips with the fact that our own people are the biggest traitors on this earth, and you look no further than the American politician for confirmation of that. You send a white WASP person or any other sort of white Gentile figure as a politician to D.C., they will sell us out quicker and act against us much quicker than blacks or Jews could ever dream of. I think that's the case. I think that's the fact. And Lyndon Johnson is a perfect example of that. Now, I will say that Lyndon Johnson, to me, looks and appearances aren't everything, and I'm certainly not Tom Brady or Brad Pitt myself, let me assure you. But Lyndon Johnson, in my opinion, looks like gold in my ear with short, slick back hair, and and it could be that he is not a Gentile or a Goy. He had big ears and that goofy-looking evil face, but at the end of the day, and I think this is a criticism on people of white, in white nationalism in general, is that they're not ready to admit that these people are people who are power driven, who are egocentric, who are ambitious, who have something to prove. These psychopath people, these people gravitate and lust towards powerful positions like congressmen, being in the House of Representatives, being a senator, being the vice president, being the president. These positions attract lustful, power-driven, power-seeking individuals. And I don't know why we continue to deny it. I don't know why we continue to act like this is not the case, that the salt of the earth, humble, honest people are the ones in there. They're not. Let me tell you something. The honest, humble, salt-of-the-earth people, I think they're more scared, they're more repulsed of going and being a politician than the politicians are in their level of avarice, greed, and their lust for power. I think honest, genuine people are totally repulsed and are a bit frightened of being in the belly of the beast with all these other jackals and hyenas. I say that out of my own personal attitude towards it. There's a lot of people you'd have to deal with, a lot of liberal people that would really drive me up the wall, and I would get disgusted and frustrated with it and probably end up walking away from it out of disgust. But look, Lyndon Johnson, let's go with this idea that he was not a Jew, that he was Gentile, Goyim, just like the rest of us here, and that he did this on his own accord towards lust and power. I'm going to lay out the case that Lyndon Johnson had the most to gain from killing JFK and was in the best position possible with his friendships, with his working relationships, with his financial backers, with his supporters, with his cronies, with his hitmen, with his connections, with his neighbors. Yes, I said neighbors, to cover this thing up, obfuscate the truth, and give not only the military, but the people in Washington, D.C., what they wanted policy-wise. And there are a few Jews in here, and there's a few people in Dallas and in Houston and in Texas. D.H. Byrd, Clint Murchison, Ed Clark, people at Bell Helicopter, people at General Dynamics, people at Kellogg, Brown, and Root. I don't know their backgrounds. They may or may not be. They may or may not be. I'm not positive. Anyways, let's get into this. I wanted to... you guys know about my foray into the topic of Vietnam and what the heck exactly happened there and why we did it. And Lyndon Johnson, the more I learn about this guy, the more it's obvious to me why we were there and why we did what we did and why so many people had to be used and abused and slaughtered and murdered to go over there and do what we did. And I'm not talking about the Vietnamese people. I'm talking about our own boys who were used and abused and sent over there for unrighteous reasons. I'm going to read about Lyndon Johnson the man as told by other people and as compiled by Roger Stone. This is going to take probably a good 15 minutes or so bear with me here. Lyndon Johnson the man. Secretary of the Senate Bobby Baker, whom Senate Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson called my strong right arm, predicted on the bitter cold January day of John F. Kennedy's inauguration in Washington, D.C., that the new president would die a violent death and would not finish his first term. Are you listening out there? Even though the LBJ Presidential Library has done a good job of cleansing Lyndon B. Johnson's public image, he was in fact a crude, vicious, duplicitous, and cowardly man who sometimes lied when it would have been easier just to tell the truth. To fully understand LBJ's role in the Kennedy assassination, one must understand Lyndon Johnson, the narcissist, the bully, the sadist, the man. Veteran JFK assassination researcher Robert Morrow correctly labels Johnson as a functioning lunatic. Longtime aides and Secret Service agents are in agreement that even before his presidency, Johnson was known for doing whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted, simply because he could. The Secret Service, the FBI, the CIA, all did a commendable job of covering up Johnson's true persona. And what an evil personality he had. Vicious, mean-spirited, vengeful, aggressive, arrogant, abusive, sex-crazed. The descriptions of his vile actions go on and on. Ronald Kessler is an American journalist, who I mentioned earlier with Joe Kennedy, right? Who authored 19 nonfiction books about the Secret Service, the FBI, and the CIA. In 2006, he became the chief Washington correspondent of Newsmax. Before that, he was an investigative reporter for the Washington Post. He was one of the first journalists to gain the trust of these organizations to expose the indecent, immoral actions of presidents all the way from Eisenhower to Obama. Kessler's 18th book, In the President's Secret Service, Behind the Scenes with Agents in the Line of Fire and the Presidents They Protect, was described by the USA Today as a fascinating exposé, a high-energy read, amusing, saucy, often disturbing anecdotes about the VIPs the Secret Service has protected and still protects. Accounts come directly from current and retired agents, most identified to name, to Kessler's credit, balancing the sordid tales are the kinder stories of presidential humanity. Kessler is a respected journalist and former Washington Post reporter, an insightful and entertaining story. In this book, Kessler explains that every source he interviewed described Johnson as completely and totally out of control. One unnamed source even stated, "If this guy was not president, he would be in a mental hospital." LBJ is as crude as the day is long, became a common analogy in his time in office. In Kessler's book, In the President's Secret Service, Agent Taylor recounts escorting Johnson, who was then the vice president, with another agent from the U.S. Capitol to the White House for a 4 p.m. meeting with Kennedy. Due to Johnson's inability to leave the U.S. Capitol on time, and because of traffic along Pennsylvania Avenue, they were going to be late. Johnson said to jump the curb and drive on the sidewalk, Taylor said. There were people on the sidewalk getting out of work. I told him no. He said, I told you to jump the curb. He took a newspaper and hit the other agent who was driving on the head. He said, you're both fired. Fortunately, when Agent Taylor told Evelyn Lincoln, President Kennedy's secretary, that the vice president had him fired, Lincoln informed him, while shaking her head in exasperation, that he was not going to be fired. Part of Johnson's erratic, reckless behavior stemmed from his reluctance to be vice president. As Robert Dallek, a Pulitzer Prize finalist and American historian specializing in American presidents, explains in his biography, Flawed Giant, Lyndon Johnson and His Times, LBJ had hoped and planned for the presidency, but the fate or the limitations of his time, place, and personality had cast him in the second spot, and he absolutely despised it. The book Protecting the President by Dennis McCarthy has a lot of anecdotes about what an epic jack A, I won't say it just out of respect for my Christian listeners, that Lyndon Johnson was. How rude and abusive he was with Secret Service agents. McCarthy writes this, Johnson had not been very well liked by any of the agents on the detail. He treated us as if we were the hired help on his ranch, cursed at us regularly, and generally was a royal pain to deal with. Johnson's alienating egoism was not unknown to President Kennedy. You are dealing with a very insecure, sensitive man with a huge ego, JFK told his aide, Kenneth P. O'Donnell. What Kennedy didn't know was how deeply rooted Johnson's desire was to be top dog. Johnson was used to bending people to his will through intimidation, an art form Washington journalists Rallon Evans and Robert Novak called the treatment. But he couldn't control Kennedy. In fact, Kennedy often excluded Johnson from matters concerning foreign policy. Johnson was jealous of Kennedy's womanizing ways as well. In Flawed Giant, Robert Dallek described that when someone mentioned Kennedy's many affairs, Johnson would bang the table and declare that he had more women by accident than Kennedy ever had on purpose. Due to his insatiable envy, LBJ might have given more women the Johnson treatment than JFK, Harding, and Clinton combined. These extensive affairs began when Johnson was vice president, but very few of his paramours were around for any great length of time. While Johnson was vice president, one of the women who held his attention longer than the rest and for whom he exhibited some really deep feelings was married off, probably because of a continued relationship, was incompatible with the vice presidency. And this was said by George Reedy, the White House press secretary from 64 to 65. Johnson filled himself with excessive eating, drinking, and smoking, and an affinity for womanizing. Sexual conquest gave him temporary respites from feeling unwanted, unloved, and unattended, wrote Robert Dallek. He is the only person or president who I've seen was drunk, said Frederick H. Waldsell, a former chief of the White House Secret Service Uniform Division. Johnson was often inebriated, stated Ronald Kessler in his book, The President's Secret Service. One evening, when Johnson was president, he came back to the White House drunk, screaming that the lights were on, wasting electricity. One agent assigned to protect Johnson recounted that the president was uncouth, nasty, and often drunk. The agent went on to say that after Lady Bird Johnson caught LBJ having an adult relationship with a secretary in the Oval Office, Johnson ordered the Secret Service to install a buzzer to warn him of when his wife would be expected to drop by. The agent said that the First Lady was well aware of the buzzer's existence and was not naive about her husband's many liaisons. Air Force One crew members had similar experiences with Johnson, who often locked the door to his stateroom and spent many hours alone behind closed doors with pretty secretaries, even when First Lady Lady Bird Johnson was aboard the flight. Folks, are you getting the picture here? Johnson would come on the plane, Air Force One, and the minute he got out of sight of the crowds, he would stand in the doorway and grin from ear to ear and say, "You dumb SOBs, I pee on all of you." This is what Robert McMillan, an Air Force One steward, told Kessler. Then he stepped out of sight and began taking off his clothes. By the time he was in the stateroom, he was down to his shorts and socks. It was not uncommon for him to peel off his shorts, regardless of who was in the stateroom. Johnson didn't care if women were around. He continued his indecent exposure without concern. He was totally naked with his daughters, with Lady Bird and female secretaries, McMillan would recall. Lyndon Johnson had absolutely no moral compass or control over his animal instincts. Dalek wrote, "When the wife of television newscaster David Brinkley accepted an invitation to visit Lyndon and Lady Bird at the ranch on a weekend when her husband couldn't be there, Johnson tried unsuccessfully to get her into bed." Sunshine Williams, today a real estate agent in Austin, tells the story of when she was a reporter for a radio station and a young fetching brunette on election day of 1964. She interviewed LBJ on the tarmac of the Houston airport. He had liquor on his breath, and he invited her to come to the LBJ ranch as a guest. Although his plane was full, and he would have to kick one of his entourage off to make enough room for her, Sunshine subsequently declined the offer. God, can you believe this? Can you believe someone would do this kind of stuff and get away with it? Do it in public, nonetheless? When LBJ would get a girl back to the isolated and secluded LBJ ranch, it would inevitably become a game of survival of the fittest for the woman as she battled off Johnson's inevitable advances. Austin used to have a music festival called Aquafest, which also crowned a beauty queen. These beauty queens, this is around 1969, would be taken to the LBJ ranch to visit the retired President Johnson, who would take them on jeep rides to secluded areas and then proceed to make advances on these poor girls. Whether drunk or sober, Johnson continued his abusive behaviors and apologized for none of it. George Edward Reedy served under LBJ from 51 to 65 and was White House press secretary for the last year. In his book, Lyndon Johnson, A Memoir, Reedy was crystal clear describing Johnson's notoriously unbalanced behavior. As president, Johnson was known for driving his staff to the verge of exhaustion and sometimes over the verge. For paying the lowest salaries for the longest hours of work on Capitol Hill, for publicly humiliating his most loyal aides, for keeping his office in a constant state of turmoil by playing games with reigning male and female favorites. Reedy also had full knowledge of the president's sexual escapades with secretaries and aides. They had to be young, they had to be cheerful, they had to be malleable, and it helped if they were slightly antagonistic to him at the onset. He dearly loved to convert an anti-Johnson liberal with a slightly plump figure and a dowdy wardrobe into a lean, impeccably clad female whose face was masked in cosmetics and who adored the ground that Johnson walked on. Johnson would, let me rephrase this, mate with anything that would crawl, basically, said William F. Cuff, the executive assistant in LBJ's military office. According to Reedy, the president's flavors of the month, who were often referred to as the harem by male staff members, enjoyed many compensations including lavish presents, travel under plush conditions, attendance at glamorous social functions with the Johnsons, expensive clothes, and frequent trips to New York, where a glamorous makeup artist would initiate her into the mysteries of advanced facial makeup, resulting in cosmetics so lavishly applied that they became a mask. Such an active and careless sexual life certainly had predictable results. Johnson was married to Lady Bird until the day he died, of course. The couple had two daughters, Linda and Lucy. But the philandering politico had three other children outside of his marriage. He admitted none of them. The first of the known Johnson illegitimate children is Stephen Brown, born in 1950 to Madeline Brown, Johnson's sexual partner across two decades. Stephen did not know the identity of his real father until the late 1980s, which, of course, LBJ died in 73, right? Until then, he thought his father might be Dallas attorney Jerome Ragsdale, a man who is charged with watching over one of LBJ's oldest secrets. Stephen Brown sued for paternity in 1987, lost, and died a suspicious death. Let me add in here, folks, you guys are just thinking, oh, well, LBJ, how much could he possibly have? He was only a senator and a president and a politician his whole life and made a public salary. False. Johnson was the biggest freaking criminal, crony, capitalist president you could ever think of. This guy had to have had, I'm going to guess, close to $100 million net worth at the time of his death. I'm telling you, this man was the biggest criminal politician and just lavishly wealthy. So this son, Stephen Brown, sued for paternity in 1987, he lost the case, and died a suspicious death. LBJ loyalist Jack Valeni would do anything for his boss. The Texas advertising executive joined the Kennedy-Johnson team as a media liaison, and later worked as President Johnson's closest aide. But he served a far more important role as a stand-in father for Lyndon Johnson's child. Valenti had been a longtime bachelor until, in 1962, at the age of 41, he married Mary Margaret Wiley, a former receptionist in Johnson's Texas office, who had relocated to Washington. She was remarkably beautiful, and the president enjoyed talking to her for hours. She would be Johnson's mistress and bear him one of at least three illegitimate children. In fact, Air Force Two pilot Ralph Albertazzi later attested to one of the many whirlwind dates the vice president had had with Wiley, from Kansas City to Austin to New York City and back to Washington, all on a whim, all on the taxpayer's dime. She was clearly special. So special that reporter Sarah McClendon alleged that Bill Moyers was brought on as a religious aide to prevent the talk of Johnson as his secretary. This is what Sarah McClendon said. Bill Moyers, who had just begun handling the press for Lyndon at that time, Moyers, who graduated from the Southwest Theological Institute in Fort Worth, had been brought to Washington because of another rumor. There had been speculation that LBJ's relationship with his top secretary, Mary Margaret Wiley, had become an intimate as well as a professional one. Concerned, Lyndon had asked his good friend Harry Provins of the Waco Tribune and several other Texas editors to look for someone to prevent that kind of talk. And who better to give the vice president's staff a more sanctified appearance than a young man headed for the ministry? So Moyers was hired on, ostensibly to deal with policy concerning religion and to answer letters that had a religious tone. In actuality, he was a chaperone who would travel with Lyndon and Mary Margaret to show that all was on the up and up. He often chaperoned their dates to discourage speculation. Many people thought that Jack Valeni was gay, and he surprised everyone when he married Mary Margaret. The couple had three children, John, Alexandra, and Courtney, Linda Valenti. Mary Margaret gave birth to daughter Courtney 3 weeks before the JFK assassination. Courtney garnered more attention from Lyndon Johnson than any of his other children. Photographs of her playing with the president in the White House were regularly published in the press. Ironically, the diminutive Valenti... I'm not going to read that part. That's not appropriate for where this show is going to air. Here's the point with Jack Valeni in this supposed marriage. Once, as Valenti prepared to end a long day at the White House, he noted to the president, LBJ, that he was eager to get home and play with his daughter. Your daughter? Johnson said with a wry smile on his face. You get the picture here, guys? This guy, I'm telling you, this guy was an absolute animal. And this man did anything he wanted, and this man got away with many murders, about 8 or 9 others besides John F. Kennedy's. All right, let me continue on. A 2009 Washington Post story detailed declassified files showing that at the same time Johnson was bedding Valenti's wife, the FBI was investigating whether Valenti, who died in 2007, was gay. Although no proof was ever found, the files offer a new perspective on his marriage to Wiley. Many speculate that he married her to give his beloved president cover for an affair that lasted 9 years and resulted in another daughter Valenti would raise as his own. I believe that's what you call a cuck. A third child, thought to be Johnson's progeny, is Lyndon K. Boozer, the daughter of LBJ Secretary Yolanda Boozer. It was in July 19th, 1963. Yolanda Garza Boozer had given birth to a boy at the Columbia Hospital for Women in Washington, D.C. Her boss, Vice President Lyndon B. Johnson, stopped by to visit the new mother and her husband, a Treasury official. Secret Service agents attested that Johnson was sleeping with 5 of his 8 secretaries. Based on the fact that he was using his secretarial pool as a harem at the time Boozer gave birth to a boy named after Lyndon, it's not difficult to surmise that Lyndon is the son of LBJ. Those who know him say he's a spitting image of the late president. History has been kind to Lyndon Johnson through all his philandering. One biographer had very good reason to write glowing tribute to the former president, and that would be Doris Kearns Goodwin, who, strangely enough, had a curiously intimate relationship with the president, especially in his retirement. She had a peculiar relationship with him, which made many tongues wag. Washington Post reporter Sally Quinn described this in 1974. Johnson was terribly possessive of her time, more and more as he came closer to death. She was seeing many men at this point in her life, but had no real attachments until she met Richard Goodwin 6 months before Johnson's death. Kearns later admitted that Lyndon Johnson used to crawl into bed with her and just talk, but nothing else was going on. Kearns Goodwin told authors Richard Harwood and Haynes Johnson that Lyndon would confess his love to her, court her aggressively, ask her to marry him, and act jealously about her lovers. Not surprisingly, Doris Kearns Goodwin has long been the subject of rumors that she was having relations with the subject of her fabulously successful first book, Lyndon Johnson and the American Dream. Aside from being a philanderer of the highest order, Lyndon Johnson's sense of humor revolved chiefly on the contents of toilet bowls and toilet humor, Reedy recounted. Rather than interrupt himself, Johnson would continue his train of thought on the toilet surrounded by his aides. Johnson particularly enjoyed the discomfort this caused among the Ivy League aides of JFK. Johnson was known, I'll just say this, I don't want to get too graphic here, but Johnson was known to force people in conferences or on the telephone to go through with him, in effect, using the restroom while they were trying to have a meeting, and he would make people stay in this bathroom with him. This is incredible. This is a pig of a man. If that were not lewd enough, Reedy recalled Johnson's favorite spectator sport was watching bovine copulation. And he gloried in summoning fastidious males to his bathroom where conference and his bodily functions would be intermingled. Now, Johnson was also fond of literally exposing himself in public, and there's a few stories about that in front of journalists, in front of foreign dignitaries, where he would joke about doing stupid stuff like that. And I don't want to read this all here because I want to play this back on a few other internet streams, and I don't think it's appropriate. I've already touched on enough risque topics here. Just know that it's on record that Lyndon Johnson would do this type of stuff that's totally unbecoming of an American president, let alone the lowest rank of a politician. A dog catcher shouldn't even be allowed to get away with this stuff in public. One of the friends of Johnson also testified to the fact that Johnson could be downright cruel. One incident was described to me by a friend of 30 years, a retired U.S. Air Force colonel who flew as an escort officer on a Johnson trip to space installations around the U.S. My friend swears he saw Johnson, then vice president, throw a Cutty Sark and a soda into the face of an Air Force steward. The reason? The sergeant had failed to use a freshly opened bottle of soda in mixing the drink. Though the Secret Service kept most of the president's unruly character relatively unknown to the American public, no one could stop Johnson from being himself in front of the camera. In 1964, LBJ created controversy while taking his beagles, named Him and Her, on a walk with the press. A photo was snapped of the president lifting him up by the ears. The image led to public outrage of animal abuse. Johnson claimed that the move was for the beagles' benefit because it lets them bark. However, animal lovers were not convinced. He had to apologize to animal rights organizations for his cruelty. In addition to being a true maniac, Johnson was also known to show no bounds when cursing profusely. Kessler shared some of LBJ's jaw-dropping racial slurs in a book called Inside the White House. An Air Force One crew member stated that the president had his own opinions about the civil rights movement, ones that were the complete opposite of his public actions to make America a great society, and he blatantly shared them with everyone in earshot. "These Negroes, they're getting pretty uppity these days, and that's a problem for us, since they've got something now they never had before, the political pull to back up their uppityness. Now we've got to do something about this. We've got to give them a little something, just enough to quiet them down. Not enough to make a difference." I'm sorry, that's my poor impression of LBJ. In a meeting aboard Air Force One, shortly after signing the Civil Rights Act, he was pleased to promise two governors aboard, "I'll have them niggers voting Democratic for the next 200 years. Well, was he wrong? He's probably going to end up being right on that one. Though Johnson may have been just a country boy from the Central Hills of Texas, George Reedy likened LBJ's antics to a Turkish sultan of Istanbul. And this particular Turkish sultan of Istanbul possessed a staggering ego which knew no bounds. To Johnson, loyalty was a one-way street, all take on his part and all give on the part of everyone else, his family, his friends, his supporters, Reedy explained. When a truly horrific person, devoid of any redeeming qualities, also harbors scathing jealousy towards the president, enough so to covet his position, this person with a history of no moral compass might, in all likelihood, use his established powers of intimidation to orchestrate the plan to assassinate JFK and succeed at it. Johnson's oddly disturbing decisions and complete lack of concern for the future of the country just hours after Kennedy's death only solidifies the fact that he had put the plan in motion and covered it up. Investigative journalist Russ Baker discloses several events involving LBJ that cannot be conceived as anything other than incriminating in his book, Family of Secrets. Pat Holloway, former attorney to both Poppy Bush and Jack Crichton, recounted to me an incident involving LBJ that had greatly disturbed him, wrote Baker. This was around 1 p.m. on November 22, 1963, just as Kennedy was being pronounced dead. As Holloway was leaving the office, he passed through the reception area, and the switchboard operator noted she was patching Johnson through from Parkland Hospital to Holloway's boss and the firm's senior partner, Waddy Bullion, who was also the vice president's tax lawyer. The operator asked if Holloway wanted to listen in. "I heard him say, 'Oh, I gotta get rid of my G.D. Halliburton stock.' Lyndon Johnson was talking about the consequences of his political problems with his Halliburton stock at a time when the president had been officially declared dead. And that pissed me off, Holloway recalled. It really made me furious. A few days later, on the evening of November 25th, LBJ was speaking to Martin Luther King and said, "It's just an impossible period. We've got a budget coming up." Baker also exposes how Johnson told Joseph Alsop later that morning, "The president must not inject himself into local killings," to which Alsop also immediately responded, "I agree with that, Mr. President, but in this case, it does happen to be the killing of the president." On this same day, LBJ also instructed J. Edgar Hoover, and this is on tape. There's a video on YouTube with this segment in it. "We can't be checking up on every shooting scrape in the country." These conversations show the epitome of an egomaniac, a sultan, an arrogant, vengeful man unable to exercise the slightest baseline of loyalty or sensitivity. More precisely, he was a cold-blooded murderer who would stop at nothing to survive and seize power. Even toward the end of his life, Lyndon Johnson stayed true to the principles he had demonstrated during his time in the White House. "If I can't have booze, sex, or cigarettes, what's the point of living?" Yes, that is a direct quote from Lyndon Johnson. Okay, there's just a little background, and of course that's the dirtiest of dirty in many respects, about Lyndon Johnson's lack of moral compass and his shoddy personality and character. Lyndon Johnson was an animal. He was a functioning lunatic. He was vicious. He was mean-spirited. He was insensitive. He was a womanizing drunk. Look at what he did, guys, with Vietnam, the USS Liberty. How many men, how many of our boys he sent to be slaughtered in the jungles of Southeast Asia, and only thought about ending it or reversing course only when military advisors and everyone else had come to the conclusion that it needed to be stopped, or that he had a serious problem facing his 1968 re-election campaign. This man was an absolute animal. Make no mistake about it. If he would do this kind of stuff in public, in front of press reporters, in front of media personnel, in front of business executives, in front of secretaries, in front of White House staff, in front of members of the military, in front of friends and family alike, the sex, the booze, the vicious, cruel statements, the insults, the condescending attitude and behavior, the everything else. If he would do this in public, do you really think this man could be trusted to not go after the president? I don't know if you know this, but Lyndon Johnson had his own sister, Josepha Johnson, murdered because she knew all the secrets of how he stole his first election to the Senate in 1948, the so-called Box 13 scandal, in which he paid one of his cronies in the sheriff or in law enforcement in one of those Texas counties to forge 200 votes days afterward. They're still stalling on reporting the votes that have come in from all the counties and jurisdictions. And he gets one of his cronies to forge 200 votes into where Lyndon Johnson wins the election by a mere 86 or 87 votes. I believe that is when he was running against Coke Stevenson for a Senate spot. And Stevenson was a former governor of the state, incredibly admired. He was a salt of the earth, Christian conservative, ranch hand, hardworking guy, very humble means, not lavish at all. Now, I mentioned about Josepha Johnson and how Lyndon had her killed to shut her up. He also killed one of the lovers of Josepha, of his sister, which would be this man, Kinzer, who was a golf pro there in Texas. who he thought was trying to blackmail him over what Josefa had told him about Lyndon stealing his election. More than that, Lyndon Johnson, like I said, had the blood of seven or eight other people besides his sister and besides John F. Kennedy on his hands. And he had many people, many connections to be able to do it. This guy had his ground to the tracks. He knew where people were because of the associations he had with people, like Billy Saul Estes, like Bobby Baker, like Malcolm Mack Wallace, a crackshot assassin, and like D.H. Byrd, like Clint Murchison, like Ed Clark, like Governor John Connolly. How about the Cables? One was the mayor of Dallas at the time of the assassination. The other was the recently fired Cable, who was in the U.S. military, who went down for the Bay of Pigs failed invasion, that they tried to manipulate JFK into helping out and escalating. Cable, his brother was mayor, and he was in a high position in the CIA or in the military. He got fired along with Alan Dulles and one other as a result. These people all had tremendous interests that collided on getting rid of Kennedy, and Johnson was the point man in covering up the investigation and making sure no one would ever touch it, and he saved himself from going to prison. That is why he is the prime suspect for JFK's assassination. It all sounds very hokey at first glance when you don't know anything about it. That was my first reaction. I thought, no way. The Jews did it. They had the most to gain. They're the ones who did it. I think there is a great case to be made for Lyndon Johnson being the murderer of John F. Kennedy. And we'll get into some of that here. Give me a moment. Let me pull up my documents here. All right, now we touched on LBJ's character. Let's get into some of the highlights. LBJ stole the election in 1948 by less than 200 votes. He ended up winning by 86 or 87 votes, but they added 200 votes with the help of one of his cronies at the last second. As a result of him winning that election, J. Edgar Hoover flew in from Washington for the celebration party at the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, where Johnson defeated Coke Stevenson for the Senate seat. J. Edgar Hoover had his own motive for the murder of John F. Kennedy as well. JFK and his brother Bobby were planning to forcefully retire J. Edgar Hoover at age 65, which would have happened in 1964 for Hoover, and J. Edgar Hoover knew it. And boy, was he scared. J. Edgar Hoover is another dastardly character who, much like LBJ, uses every little position he has as director of the FBI to run his own little fiefdom. He's got blackmail, he's got files on everyone, and he uses it to consecrate his own power. J. Edgar Hoover should be rightfully described by historians as an American Stalin. That's what he ought to be known as. Interestingly, LBJ and Hoover were next-door neighbors in D.C. for years, decades. Surely, they became thick as thieves, as the saying goes. LBJ was instrumental, from the time he was a senator to the vice president to the president, in tripling the FBI's budget while J. Edgar Hoover is in office. And of course, what does JFK do with the CIA and FBI once he's in there? Him and Bobby running things. They cut the money, slowly but surely, out of the CIA, out of the intelligence communities, out of the FBI. In 1960, LBJ receives a dossier on JFK's philandering, thanks to Hoover, and uses it as blackmail to get on the presidential ticket. He says, "You need me. You need Texas. Accept me, or I'll give the dossier, with all of your philandering, to Nixon, and I'll boost him to the White House." Kennedy then accepts LBJ as his running mate. The next day, a reporter in shock. Now remember, Lyndon Johnson is the majority leader in the Senate. He is the most powerful senator. He's representing the Democrats. He holds a very, very influential position, and he's going to give it up to become vice president? What kind of sense does that make? The next day, a reporter in shock asks LBJ, why in the world would you give up your Senate position as the majority leader just to be the vice president? LBJ responds by saying, you know, I checked and 1 in 4 vice presidents have become president upon the death of the president. Now, frankly, I'm a gambling man and I like those odds. Now, Bobby Baker, LBJ's personal advisor, his right-hand man and the secretary to the Senate, states at JFK's inauguration that JFK will not live out his term and he will die a violent death. This is 3 years before the execution in Dallas. LBJ is marginalized by the Kennedys. He's sent away from the White House and he's largely cut out of the loop and sent out on small tasks like ceremonies, meeting with foreign dignitaries at these little meetings and official gatherings, dinners, what have you, and funerals. He goes from one of the most powerful senators on Capitol Hill to a mere errand boy for the Kennedy White House. In 1963, as the 1964 elections are getting closer by the day, and of course, there's a whole background with the fight in Texas in the Democratic Party, the liberals of the Democratic Party, particularly between Senator Ralph Yarborough and John Connally, who is governor at the time. Now, John Connally is a protege of Lyndon Johnson. He's not some just happenstance Texas politician. You got to remember this. John Connally is a personal protege of Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson teaches John Connally the ropes of politics. Now, as I was saying, in 1963, as the 64 elections get closer by the day, JFK has an exceptionally high approval rating, but he knows he's going to need southern states. He knows he's going to need Texas, and he thinks he can go down there, and he's been invited down. He's been lured into the trap, particularly by John Connally, who asked him to come down there and bolster his own ratings, get in front of the Texas people, who he wants to show really love JFK, and he can bolster his chances for re-election in 64. If he does that, he can also patch up some of the hard feelings between particularly Ralph Yarborough and Lyndon Johnson and John Connally. Okay, keep that in mind here. Yarborough and Lyndon do not get along. Yarborough and John Connally do not get along. And JFK thinks he can go down there and pay them a favor and try to restore relations in Texas in the Democrat Party. So as these elections get closer by the day, LBJ gets jammed up with serious legal trouble. Two scandals involving Bobby Baker and Billy Saul Estes. Bobby Baker is about to go down for bribery crimes to the tune of millions of dollars with some of these kickback deals he makes with businesses in the Texas area and congressional legislation. He and LBJ are partners in these ventures. LBJ is tied into Bobby Baker. Everyone knows it. Bobby Baker and LBJ are thick as molasses, and everyone knows it. And Bobby Baker, if anything, learned his tricks from LBJ and is doing the bidding of LBJ. As a matter of fact, the Senate has opened investigations. On November 22nd, the day of the assassination, there are hearings going to be held. Investigations are going to be commenced. Are you hearing me? Johnson's neck is on the line, and boy, is he ever feeling the heat. He's feeling the heat like he's never felt it before. He's panicked. What is he going to do? How's he going to get out of this? He also knows, LBJ that is, that he's under Department of Justice investigations, which are spurred by Bobby Kennedy, who wants Johnson off the 64 ticket. This investigation concerns his dealings with another man, Billy Saul Estes, who's a flamboyant Texas Wheeler dealer who, with LBJ, have looted federal agriculture contracts, again to the tune of millions of dollars. This isn't going away easily. RFK has leaked this information to Life magazine, which later became Time Life or Time magazine, which has 9 reporters on the ground digging into LBJ's financial background for a December 1st edition expose, which will bring a federal conviction and prison time. On top of all this, Kennedy tells his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, that Johnson will be off the 64 ticket, though he hasn't decided on a firm replacement at the moment. He's considering one of the Carolina governors at the time. I forget the name. He says this to Evelyn Lincoln. This is documented. Johnson is going to be off the ticket. I don't know who it's going to be. We're not going to deal with that until we get closer to the convention. Johnson's off the ticket. He's going to be axed by the Kennedy brothers. He's going to go down. He's not going to have any pull in the White House. He's going to face 2 investigations, which are going to likely bring 2 prosecutions via Bobby Baker and Billy Celestis. The investigations are starting November 22nd, 1963. Do you see the motivation for LBJ here? It's not just a power grab. We're talking LBJ's very survival. He has got to do something, or else he's going to go down and he's going to be out of the public light. He's going to lose everything he has. We're talking prison time. Federal prison time. He can either off Kennedy right now, or he can go to prison. Those are his only 2 choices. He's got to choose. His plotting against Kennedy isn't over a petty power grab. It's literally a matter of survival. Fortunately for LBJ, finding co-conspirators to move against Kennedy isn't difficult, for the president has made numerous enemies in the power structure, most notably J. Edgar Hoover. LBJ was the appropriator for the CIA. He controlled the purse strings as a senator. He sits on the secret subcommittee that passes the black box budgets, which are hidden in the aerospace budgets. The CIA cannot function without the hundreds of millions of dollars being appropriated to it. He controls the money for the military-industrial complex. No defense contract moves in D.C. without LBJ's payoff. You put cash in a briefcase, you give it to Bobby Baker, and he delivers it to Kennedy. If you want to meet with LBJ, if you want to get legislation passed, you go through Bobby Baker and you pay the money up front. $25K, $50K, $75K, $100K in a briefcase. And it goes to Bobby Baker, and you will get a meeting to meet with Bobby Baker and make your case for what you want. You don't talk to LBJ until you talk to Bobby Baker and pay the money. LBJ is the literal godfather of the CIA in Washington, D.C. He helped get it off the ground. He's on the committees. He's one of the overseers of it. As he leaves the Senate to be vice president, he ensures his crony, Harry F. Byrd's installation as the congressional oversight that oversees the CIA. Now let's move on to the mob. We talked about J. Edgar Hoover and the CIA and their reasons to want to move against Kennedy. The mob, particularly the Giancana branch of the mob in Chicago, they paid $1 million to Joe Kennedy and Kennedy's run and delivered electoral victories in Chicago, West Virginia, and Texas, like we mentioned earlier. In return, Joe Kennedy, former partner of Frank Costello in New York, promises the mob that Santos Trafficante Jr. and Carlos Marcello will not face deportation, which was enacted under the Eisenhower administration, the Eisenhower years. They start grabbing mobsters and deporting them. The Kennedy boys double-cross the mob. They bug them, they wiretap them, they harass them, they taunt them, they trail them in public. RFK actually kidnaps Carlos Marcello and dumps him in the middle of Guatemala, leaving him for dead. The House Select Committee on Assassinations pick up recordings of Traficante and Carlos Marcello discussing the fact that Kennedy would be killed before it actually happened. There's even recordings after the murder of Traficante taking credit. Carlos Marcello is one of LBJ's biggest financial supporters. LBJ takes around $50,000 annually as a bribe to keep the DOJ off mob gambling activities. Of course, all of RFK's wiretap initiatives on the mob are immediately reversed after LBJ is sworn in as president. And we all know about how LBJ reversed the policy on withdrawing 1,000 boys out of Vietnam that Kennedy put forward. LBJ reverses this within a matter of days of Kennedy being pronounced dead, being murdered in Dallas. The CIA and their operatives involved in the failed Bay of Pigs invasion against Cuba and Castro are steamed over Kennedy's refusal to escalate the conflict by refusing to supply air support to the invasion. They see this as a betrayal, as a backstabbing by Kennedy. They openly speak of Kennedy and Castro in parties and get-togethers, the likes of which David Ferry, who's another conspirator, Clay Shaw, and anti-Castro Cubans. This is actually captured in the film JFK. Funny enough, the mob is intertwined with the agency, the CIA, to overthrow Fidel because Fidel runs the mob-connected casinos out of Cuba. I can't help but think this is a big reason. It's not just because the mob, the CIA, and these dark, spooky intel guys hate communism. That's not the reason exactly for they're wanting to overthrow Fidel Castro in Cuba. It is not an ideological thing for them. It's because Fidel Castro comes in and shuts down the gambling and the mob organized crime activities that take place in Cuba. Texas oilmen, like a few that I already mentioned, D.H. Byrd, Clint Murchison, these people also have reason to fear Kennedy over his stance on the oil depletion reserve policies. He wants to repeal this sweetheart tax break deal, which will cost big oil, these bigwigs, hundreds of millions of dollars annually. Who courts big oil interest in D.C.? Take a wild guess. None other than LBJ. There are also parties upset over Kennedy's handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which he's more than generous with Khrushchev, agreeing to remove missile positions from Turkey and Italy. Khrushchev got major concessions and won that deal, which is why it's totally absurd for LBJ and the others to attempt to blame the Russians for Kennedy's murder. Khrushchev took Kennedy to the cleaners. No one likes to point that out. And if Ronald Reagan had done that, like Roger Stone points out, Reagan would have got murdered, would have got impeached over it. He would be seen as a weakling. But Kennedy yields to Khrushchev in the effort for peace and gives Khrushchev the better end of the deal to get the thing done. If anything, the Russians and Khrushchev want to keep Kennedy around. In fact, it's even reported in the days following the Kennedy assassination, Khrushchev is beside himself. Khrushchev is pacing around frantically and is very hurt, is very disturbed over the news that JFK is killed. French intelligence, at the request of Jackie Kennedy Onassis, Jackie Bouvier Kennedy Onassis, she would come to be, they reach out to French intelligence because the Kennedys, Bobby and Jackie, can't get anything from J. Edgar Hoover. They reach out to the Russian intelligence agencies and French, and they both conclude that LBJ is the one who organized and carried out the assassination and covered it up. He is the one who has the most to gain. interesting side note I wanted to throw in there. The 1948 election, let me recap on this because I wasn't very specific. 200 voters were added to the rolls at the last second, and they just happened to be signed in alphabetical order in the same handwriting and the same ink on the voting rolls, the registration rolls, and Johnson wins by a grand total of 86 or 87 votes. When Officer Jim Southwick threatened to visit the U.S. Attorney's office and spill the beans, he's found dead a few hours later. No doubt this is one of the murders that LBJ and his men are connected to. Malcolm Wallace, Malcolm Mac Wallace as he's called, is one of LBJ's personal hitmen, and he is a crack shot assassin. He is an expert marksman. He's not like Lee Harvey Oswald, while in the Marines, who was known to be a very poor shot, had no interest in rifle training, and was more of an intellectual. Malcolm Mac Wallace is an expert. There are three levels. Expert is the top. It is the gold, not the bronze or the silver. And Malcolm Mac Wallace is Johnson's personal hitman and personal assassin. Malcolm Mac Wallace will later appear in Dealey Plaza in the JFK assassination, believe it or not, and will be one of the prime suspects. Now, I will add, for people who are interested, I have not released any of them yet, but I will be posting an audio version of Jim Garrison's book, On the Trail of the Assassins, which is currently being wrapped up for post-production, should I say. And it goes into the ins and outs of Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination and what Jim Garrison found in his investigation into the JFK assassination. Jim Garrison is a hero. There is no doubt about it. He is an American hero. He is up there with Joe McCarthy in my book. He is the father of JFK assassination research. Mark Lane is another one who was very early on, a very early critic, and pointed out the obvious flaws in the Warren Commission testimony. Mark Lane is the one who was associated with Willis Cardo and the Spotlight, Liberty Lobby, and American Free Press, I'm pretty sure. Now, Mark Lane, since I brought him up, he's a questionable character, in my opinion, because he has connections to Jim Jones, the Jonestown Massacre that happens in the 70s. I think Mark Lane is on the scene there and is a close associate with Jim Jones. And a lot of people have, especially in on RBN and the anti-Zionist crowd, Daryl Smith and others, they have heavily criticized Mark Lane, saying that he was the backdoor secret Jew controller of the American Free Press. I don't know if any of these allegations are correct, but I throw him out there because give credit where credit is due. Mark Lane was very early on criticizing and openly questioning and writing books about how the Warren Commission's findings were absolutely wrong and the whole thing was a giant cover-up. So let me go into, since we're about 90 minutes in here, I've given you the quick breakdown, which you can dig into further for details and more facts. Let's go into Dealey Plaza, November 21st. Of course, the Kennedy clan, they're in Fort Worth, which, if you're not familiar with the map of Texas, Fort Worth, Dallas, they're largely considered one big area. They're about 30 miles apart, I think, and they're very close together, kind of like Chicago, Milwaukee, that type of thing. Fort Worth and Dallas are even closer together. The Kennedy clan and the presidential, the White House, they stop in Fort Worth on November 21st, the day before they head to Dallas. The night of November 21st, there is a house party that happens, to which Lyndon Johnson later strolls into at around 11 o'clock. And it happens to be the meeting of the conspirators to assassinate John F. Kennedy. Now, the meeting takes place at Clint Murchison. That's Murchison. In Texas, in Dallas, all the conspirators get together to meet. And it just so happens that there's a whole cast of characters present, including Richard Nixon. Now, Richard Nixon is not in on the conspiracy, but later on, in years to come, he will be very, very curious and will make some very interesting statements to confidants and aides like Roger Stone about how he knew Lyndon Johnson is the one who pulled it off. And Nixon would later be quoted as saying, "Lyndon and I both wanted the White House. We were both ambitious. The only difference is I wasn't willing to kill for it." That is a quote that Richard Nixon told Roger Stone. Interesting, don't you think? Nixon is there at the party, the early on party. After the party is over, there is a meeting, a closed door meeting. D.H. Byrd, Clint Murchison, Bobby Baker, John Connolly, Lyndon Johnson comes in at 11 o'clock. People are stunned, including Madeline Brown, who has one of Lyndon's illegitimate children, Stephen Brown, who died under mysterious circumstances, remember? Madeline Brown spilled a lot of the beans about Lyndon and his involvement in the JFK assassination in interviews that she had done with Robert Galen Ross. They're all over YouTube, guys. You can go in and watch these. I suggest you do. They're very, very interesting in what they talk about. Cliff Carter, another Johnson crony, is there. Many of the conspirators are at this meeting. They discuss what's going to go down. They discuss what's going to happen. They discuss the cover-up. They discuss the official story. D.H. Byrd is a big Texas oilman. Ed Clark is big in the lawyer profession. He is there attending. D.H. Byrd owns the Texas School Book Depository, where the conspirators just happened to get Lee Harvey Oswald employment about 5 to 6 weeks prior, 6 weeks earlier. And they just changed the motorcade route so that it drives right in front of the Texas School Book Depository, conveniently slowing down the motorcade to about 10 miles an hour or less to make this turn onto Elm Street, which runs right in front of the Texas School Book Depository conveniently. I believe Malcolm Wallace is also in attendance at this party. Madeline Brown is the one who tells about this story, and what she says is that after the story, Lyndon Johnson is mad. He is PO'd. He reportedly grabs Madeline Brown's arm forcefully and whispers to her, "This will be the last damn time these Kennedy boys ever embarrass me." He doesn't give the specifics. This is the night before the assassination. Now, another interesting story is the morning of the assassination, before they leave Fort Worth and head over to Dallas on the flight to Love Airfield in Dallas. Johnson goes into the room with John Kennedy, and understanding what's about to happen and the arrangement that they have set up for the motorcade and going through Dallas and going through Dealey Plaza, going in front of the Texas School Book Depository, Kennedy thinks it's a good idea, and this is what they had agreed upon, this is how it's going to be arranged, that the motorcade that John Connolly, Lyndon Johnson's protege and student, John Connolly and his wife are going to ride with John and Jackie in the very first car of the motorcade. Now, Johnson understands what's going to happen later that day in Dealey Plaza. So what does Johnson do? Johnson argues vehemently, strongly, that he thinks it's a better idea if Ralph Yarborough, who Lyndon hates, Lyndon despises Ralph Yarborough, switch place with John Connolly and ride in the same car with John and Jackie on the jump seats in front of John and Jackie. Now, Lyndon does this because he knows what's going to take place, that assassins are going to open fire on Kennedy's car in the motorcade. And he attempts a last-minute deal to get Connolly out of there to ride with him and to get one of his enemies, Yarborough, in there instead in case these marksmen aren't so on the spot this particular day in Dallas. Kennedy, who's been told he needs to come to Dallas and is prodded to come to Dallas by John Connolly and Lyndon Johnson's boys in Texas and is lured into the trap, so to speak, thinks that he's down there to patch up misgivings with the Democrat Party in little local rivalries like Yarborough and Lyndon, and Yarborough and John Connolly. And because he wants to set the record straight and put it down in stone and unify his party, so to speak, he tells Lyndon no. He rebuffs Lyndon and tells him, "We are not going to change the motorcade. Connolly is riding with me, and that's the end of it." Jackie Kennedy comes in at the tail end of this argument into the hotel room where they're staying that night, the previous night in Fort Worth. She later recalls that Lyndon stormed out of the room like a pistol, and you could tell he was mad. Now, folks, if this doesn't give you a good indication as to what's going on in Lyndon Johnson's guilt and his foreknowledge, his advanced knowledge that an assassination is going to take place later that day, I don't know what else to tell you. This should be pretty obvious. Now, it is known, too, that John Connolly and his men, they set up this trip and lure Kennedy and the White House down there, and Kennedy and his staff tries to dictate many of the arrangements beforehand while they're on the phone speaking about this and setting it up over the phone. Connolly and his men tell the White House people, "This is our trip, we're going to plan it, we're going to handle it, and if you can't accept it, maybe we ought to scrap the whole thing and just forget it. You guys stay in Washington, we don't want you, don't need you to come down here." Folks, the entire idea, the entire reason behind the Texas visit is to get Kennedy down there in Dallas where they can open fire on him and kill him and get him out of the way and get Lyndon in there. That is the whole purpose the conspirators had for the trip to Dallas by John Kennedy and company. There's an infamous photo. There's many infamous photos that were taken in Dealey Plaza. And funnily enough, there's many more that were confiscated, cameras taken, film taken. Gordon Arnold had his film taken by one of the shooters on the grassy knoll who was in a cop uniform. Beverly Oliver, the very lovely Beverly Oliver, might I add, who was a dancer at one of the strip clubs next to Jack Ruby's place, is taking a picture and has it confiscated by an unidentified Secret Service agent because it contains information which may prove to be very, very contradictory to the official findings of the Warren Commission. There are many powerful pieces of evidence that were recorded in photo and video that day that are later never found and never recovered, but most telling of all may be a photograph that is simply referred to as the Altgens, Altgens photo, which shows the procession, the rest of the procession, behind John Kennedy's car in the motorcade in the seconds leading up to, after the first shot is fired, and up leading up to the famous headshot, the fatal coup de grace which kills John Kennedy. The photo happens to record, not only in my opinion, one of the shooters hanging off the fire stairwell, the fire escape off the Daltex building, but it also happens to record Johnson's car in the motorcade. And funny enough, you see the two drivers of the car. You see the driver, the rider in the shotgun seat, who are both Secret Service agents. And then you also see Lady Bird and Ralph Yarborough waving to the crowd. Funny enough, you look over in the picture to where Lyndon Johnson is to be seated, and guess what? Lyndon Johnson is not there. The reason for this is that Lyndon Johnson, before any shot is fired, before the first shot is fired, as the cars are turning from Houston to Elm Street, making that very sharp turn that is against any normal Secret Service protocol for a presidential motorcade, Lyndon Johnson ducks down in the seat, knowing that shots are going to be fired, anticipating that danger is ahead. He ducks down before anybody. And he would later lie and say that one of his Secret Service agents pushed him down to the floor of the car. After Johnson's death, one of the Secret Service agents, the one who Johnson named, would later contradict the story, saying that the president told him to lie and go along with it and that he did not push Lyndon down. How does he know gunshots are coming? How does he know to hit the floor just as the procession is turning from Houston to Elm Street? How does he know this is going to happen, folks? Very simply, because he's a conspirator. He set the whole thing up. And his boys, not limited to, but including Malcolm Mac Wallace, I should say, is how he's known, and Loy Factor, who is an Indian crackshot assassin himself, which Mac Wallace pays for his services the day of the assassination in the Texas School Book Depository building. These were the two assassins in the Texas School Book Depository. It was not Lee Harvey Oswald. It was Malcolm Mac Wallace, who later wrote wrote a letter to the officials in Washington, D.C. that he would go on the record. Him and Billy Saul Estes would go on the record. Billy Saul Estes is the one who wrote this letter, I'm sorry. Talking about 8 or 9 murders that Lyndon Johnson was personally involved in, and the last one included John F. Kennedy's murder, and it had an asterisk next to it. And Billy Saul Estes was going to lay it all out. And Mac Wallace, funnily enough, has a fingerprint that is found in the sixth floor, the sniper's nest, the sniper's window of the school book depository on the sixth floor. Malcolm Wallace fingerprints are found all over boxes in that sixth floor sniper's nest. We're talking a 34-point match of a fingerprint, which it only takes about 4 points of match to be legally admissible in a United States court for a criminal investigation in a criminal case. Malcolm Mac Wallace has a 34-point match fingerprint found in the sniper's nest, the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository. Now, I think it's incontrovertible that there was at least one shooter, probably more, on the grassy knoll. And I've heard the stories of the people coming out. It's very well circulated that James Files is the grassy knoll shooter. I've seen that information. I've seen the interviews with him. He also claims that handsome Johnny Roselli is there in Dealey Plaza as one of the assassins, one of the gunmen, and that Chuck Giancana, the brother of Sam, and Charles Nicoletti are also there in the Daltex building firing on John F. Kennedy. I believe there were multiple assassins. I believe there was even a shooter on or near or under somehow the triple overpass, because John Kennedy had an entrance wound in his throat, and it was not James Files or any of the grassy knoll shooters at that particular angle who could have given him this head-on throat entry wound. So there were many, many people, and Lee Harvey Oswald was not on the sixth floor. He is on the second floor. That is testified to in the lunchroom, in the break room, sipping a Coke about 75 to 90 seconds after the assassination. Totally calm, not out of breath, not winded, not bewildered, not nervous, not anything. Now, we are running out of time here, and I can't cover everything from 400 pages of research. I can't cover every little story, but I hope I've given you enough to whet your interest and to lead you to look further into this story. It's a most incredible story. Most incredible. And look, the whole point with this episode today is that you are doing yourself a huge disservice to have the thought in your head, like I did before I came across and really looked into this information, that it was the Jews, it wasn't LBJ. LBJ is a prime suspect in this murder, and in my opinion, if anyone ought to fry for the murder of John F. Kennedy, it would have been Lyndon Johnson. Considering everything else that Lyndon Johnson did while he was in the White House as president, it's terribly unfortunate, in my opinion, that the boys coming back from Vietnam didn't band together, grab the rifles, force their way down Pennsylvania Avenue, grab Lyndon Johnson and lynch him on the White House lawn for all the dirty deeds he had done, including, and most of all, the Vietnam War. But you got to remember, too, Lyndon Johnson is also a prime suspect in the USS Liberty. Now, that's another one where people are going to lose their minds when I insist that LBJ was more than a puppet and that it wasn't all Israel or the Jews' fault there. I think Lyndon Johnson is one of the biggest criminals in American history as far as politicians go. And people like to talk about the Bushes or the Clintons today. The fact is, 50 years ago, before the Bushes and Clintons rose to power, it was LBJ who wrote the book on graft and corruption and pay for play and power grabbing and working your way up the ladder and becoming president through dark, deceptive means. Lyndon Johnson wrote the book. Lyndon Johnson is the original gangster politician. There is so much more to this story, and if you guys haven't, I suggest you do. There are many people who have written books about LBJ, the mastermind behind the Kennedy assassination. Roger Stone wrote one. Roger Stone did a great job compiling all the different sources and really wove together a great story in his book. I suggest you read that. Philip F. Nelson wrote another one, LBJ, the mastermind of the killing of Kennedy. That's another good one. The Man on the Sixth Floor talks about how Loy Factor and Malcolm McWallace are seen as testified by witnesses in Dealey Plaza. In some photographs and recordings, they see a man with dark hair, dark complected, possibly Hispanic or some other dark jet black hair origin, with horned rim glasses, and they see another man standing with him in one of the sixth floor windows holding a rifle, and appears to be either Negro or very dark complected and has a bald spot on his forehead. I am convinced that this is Malcolm McWallace and Loy Factor, his Native American assassin crackpot, or crack shot, I should say, crack shot assassin friend, who he pays to help carry out the job with him that day, and they are seen running from the back of the building on the loading docks of the Texas School Book Depository and jumping in a Nash Rambler station wagon and leaving the scene of the crime. And that is testified by many people. And, of course, the Dallas police, Jesse Curry, the Dallas police are told to stand down. They're there in Dealey Plaza witnessing the procession. They are ordered not to interfere. LBJ has his top secret serviceman running the lack of security, and many of the secret security boys are kept out until 5 in the morning the night before in Fort Worth, getting liquored up and partying, and most assuredly affecting their performance the next day, I would assume. And they're told to stand back. The two men on the back bumper of the Kennedy car are ordered off while the procession starts up in Love Airfield, I should say. They're ordered off by Agent Emery Roberts. Don Lawton and Henry Ripsk are the two officers who are pulled off the back of the Kennedy car. And assassinations don't just happen. They are allowed to happen. They are engineered to happen. There was an engineered lack of security that day that allowed John Kennedy to be shot and killed, and all the evidence points towards Johnson and his Secret Service man, who was one of his best pals, his best buddies. They stole the body from Parkland Hospital, and the story goes on and on. I'm running out of time here. I want to leave time for an intro and then an outro and maybe a recording about advanced prior knowledge. So until next time, this is Ted signing off. Praise Christ, praise Yahweh. Good day to everyone. Bye-bye.
I don't know. Ted is coming here, I think, on the 18th or something like that, to make some kind of speech. I think it's the 18th he's supposed to be here to make a speech. I don't know what it was about.
If you can bet your mind now, you're going to have a lot to say about giving because there's so many of them here.
Well, we had to set up the tape recorder in Somerset's apartment in order to make the recording where he met with this other man, Milter. In order to do so, it was a very large tape recorder that was made especially for intelligence work, weighing approximately 40 pounds. I carried it to the third floor of his apartment. placed it in a closet and then ran the microphone around the baseboard in the kitchen, and the microphone was hidden by the chairs where Milter and Somerset would to have their meeting.
A lot of that people said, well, there's more money there, it's more easy to get. Why the hell do you figure that that's where we'd be getting? I'm an office building. Anything else is a bomb? Sure it is. And they're gonna really try to kill it. Get this Kennedy, I tell you, it's gonna be a hard time. I believe. You may have figured out how to get it wrong, but I don't know how them Secret Service, they never come over the office building to anywhere he's going. Do you know whether to do that or not?
I'll say, yeah, if they have any suspicions.
Astoundingly, the conversation came up that this man wanted to know how many people that President Kennedy had that was his lookalike that went with him. And our informant wanted to know why, and he said, well, there was plans to assassinate him. The further conversation on the tape revealed that the assassination was to take place from an office building with a high-powered rifle. There was no particular city mentioned, or was there any particular person mentioned that was to do the assassination. The tape was made on November the 9th, and John F. Kennedy, President Kennedy, was due in Miami on the 18th of November, 1963. So the close proximity of the tape being made and his visit made quite a few changes in the security. They changed the motorcade, and I believe that he was helicoptered, and rather than have a motorcade, additional men were secured. Everyone was made aware that there may be a problem, so there was a drastic change in the procedures. He wasn't as accessible in this city as he might have been in the past.
What that Kennedy did get shot, we gotta know who he is. Yeah, but you know what, I thought that would be a real shame if they do that.
It would be nice when the stone unturned there, no, no way.
Oh, hell no.
And
they'll pick up somebody
in an hour after.
We thought we did a good job and was very grateful the fact it did not happen in Miami. It could have very well happened in Miami, as it did in Dallas. So it touched each of us very, very closely, particularly myself, as hearing the words that they were going to assassinate President Kennedy.
Why the hell are you doing the best way to be good? I'm still in the high market. Right? And they're going to really try to kill it.
Yes?
J. Edgar Hoover on 2192.
Are you familiar with this proposed group that they're trying to put together on this study of your report and other things, two from the House, two from the Senate, somebody in the court, a couple of outsiders?
No, I haven't heard of that. I've seen the reports on this on the Senate Investigating Committee that they've been talking about.
Yeah, well, we think if we don't have, I want to get by just with deer fowling your report.
I think it would be very, very bad to have a rash of investigations.
Well, the only way we can stop them is probably to appoint a high-level one to evaluate your report.
Yeah.
And put somebody that's pretty good on it from that I could select.
Well, we've got your pretty good report.
Well, what difference did it make which bullet got Connally?
Well, it don't make much difference, but they said that they believe, that the commission believes that the same bullet that hit Kennedy hit Connally. Well, I don't believe it.
I don't either.